Hell Yes Life, episode 50. Welcome to the Hell Yes Life podcast, the show that helps you come alive so you can live a hell yes life. I'm your host, Norman Bell. Hello, Hell Yes Lifers, and welcome to episode 50 of the Hell Yes Life podcast. Congratulations, we made it. Let's do a hell yes together, shall we? Ready? On the count of three. One, two, three. Hell yes. Oh yeah, we made it. One thing I've been learning how to do in recent years is to celebrate, you know, and to acknowledge milestones. And that's something that I haven't done in the past. I'll just kind of, okay, I made it to this point. Now I'm going to move on to the next thing and then the next thing and the next thing. It's always focused on the next problem, right? But we need to celebrate our wins as well. So congratulations to all of us for making it to episode 50. Now this week, to celebrate episode 50, I have put together a collection of some of my favorite stories from the first 49 episodes of the Hell Yes Life podcast. All of these stories are about turning point moments where the teller or guest faces has faced some sort of challenge and learned something from it. Now, I'm just going to play one story after the other, so I'm going to introduce them now. In this episode, you're going to hear stories from Kito Kutla, Peter Faisa, Felice Cohen, Kathy Tuckero, Dave Sanderson, Kathy O'Dowd, and Chris Ballou. Now, there'll be links to the individual episodes in the show notes. And next week, we'll be back with a new interview episode. But for now, enjoy this fine collection of HYL stories.
So I've always thought of myself as being, you know, a successful entrepreneur, right? You know, graduating college within like 3 years and having my first engineering job before even getting out of college. And I thought life was good, just kind of going up, you know, at a gradual incline. You know, life is good, graduated from college, got my first real job, right? And then moved up to the Seattle area and worked for a Hewlett Packard as their engineer, and things were going great, and I got into investing in real estate, right? Mm-hmm. So investing real estate part time, and I decided, oh wow, you know, I was doing better part time as a, you know, in real estate versus full time in engineering. And not that I didn't like the engineering part, but I kind of like the flexibility of being an entrepreneur, having my own schedule and doing my own thing. And so bought up a lot of real estate. And you know, by the time I was 30, I was doing extremely well, right? 10 mm-hmm. rental properties and things were just going up. I thought, hey, by the time I'm 40, I should be, you know, I should be ready to kind of, you know, live my life, right? The retirement at 40. That was my concept.
Oh, yeah.
And what had happened was, you know, and I'm sure you can remember this, back in 2009 when the real estate market tanked. At that time, I was at like the lowest point in my life. You know, mm-hmm. here I am, you know, have three kids and supporting a family, and I just couldn't get anything to work for me, right? The income I made before just wasn't coming in, and I was bleeding financially, and literally just financially just kind of wiped me out. And, you know, and being as a man, you know, being able to provide for my family and take care of, I, at that time, I felt that I wasn't able to do that, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was, I can remember it was my daughter's birthday. And, you know, and we were having a little birthday celebration for her. And, you know, while everybody was like downstairs, I had to sneak into her room to go into her piggy bank. Mm. Yeah, I had to go into her piggy bank to grab some money in there so I can go out and buy her a birthday gift.
Wow.
Okay. So, and I snuck downstairs after I got the money and, you know, told me, hey, I'll be right back. So I was driving down looking, you know, and I just thought to myself, what did I just do? Mm. You know, taking money from my own daughter's piggy bank so I can give her a birthday gift. And I just remember it was just really like a defining moment in my life, you know. Like up to this point, I felt like I'd been pretty, you know, pretty successful. And, you know, I thought I had my life together. But getting to that lowest point where I just felt like I couldn't just really do anything for myself, you know, not alone, you know, get something for my daughter on her birthday. Mm. So, and I was just, you know, as I was driving, I was just so upset and so mad. I had all these like emotions running through me, you know, and I was just crying out like, you know, Lord God, you know, help me. Like I'm a good person, you know, I've done the best that I could and now I'm reduced to this, you know? And, and I was just, you know, I had to pull over because, you know, tears were just coming out of my eyes, you know, and I just really beaten the crap out of myself for, you know, for who I am or who I was at the time, you know, and that was just like the lowest point. Like that was like the turning point. It's like, you know, like no more, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm not going to continue to go down this path. I've really got to, you know, find a way to get myself out. I mean, I didn't really know how I was going to do it, right? But I knew that this was not the life that I was meant to live, mm-hmm. you know? And sure, in the past, I mean, I've delved into personal development, you know, years prior, and I just, you know, but even at the time, it was just so bleak for me, Norman, that I was like my wit's end, you know, and then at the time I really like, you know, I'm a believer. So, you know, I prayed, mm-hmm. I prayed like, Lord, you know, help me find a way out. Like, you know, help me be the man that you created me to be. Cause I know that this is not the plan you have for me. And so from that point, I just really, I mean, it was, you know, I guess in terms of, it wasn't like a drastic change and boom, you know, things changed for me like overnight. But that was just kind of the callus that started on my journey, starting climbing myself back out of the abyss that I felt that I was in at that moment.
So that my absolute passion in life, my stand in life, without a doubt, is to help others break through any fear that stands between them and their ultimate vision in life, their dreams. And so that's the thing that gets me going. That's my passion.
Awesome. Awesome. And I'm sure, you know, I know I can, and I'm sure our listeners can really relate to fear. There's our old buddy fear that comes with us, throughout our life journeys. Mm-hmm. And it's really like, you know, one of Peter's specialties is really looking at like, how do we address that fear when it comes up in all of its different shapes and forms? Right. So, when did you first realize that this was one of your big hell yeses, sort of helping people work through their fear?
Right. So yeah, thanks for asking. It was a few years ago and I was well on my way to, achieving my dreams in the film world. And I was completely stopped. I got out of a 14-year relationship. I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. You know, I was trying to figure out how I was going to get out of that situation. And it was emotionally, energetically, spiritually, physically, everything the lowest I've ever been in my entire life by far.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was the dip. And at that moment, I wasn't really interested in helping anybody with their hell yes or their passion. I was just primarily concerned with getting myself out of this place. And I didn't know how to do it. And it came one day, it was just one fateful day that I was out to dinner with my dad. Do you mind if I go into this story?
Go ahead.
Hello.
Go ahead.
All right, let's rock and roll. So I'm single. I didn't really know what I was going to do with my life. And, you know, I'm out to dinner with my dad and I'm just sitting there with my father and I'm looking at him and he's looking at me and we're having dinner. And I've told you this before, but across from me was this beautiful young woman. And I had this huge connection with her. She was looking at me and I was looking at her and we smiled at each other. I was like, holy crap, here's a woman who's actually showing interest in me. She's beautiful. She looks like she's fairly intelligent, you know, telling these things. And I was like, I really like this girl. And throughout the dinner, I'm looking at her and we're stealing glances at each other. And then at some point, her mom and her sister get up and they go to the bathroom. And at the exact same time, my father gets up and he goes to the bathroom. And it's just her and me. And she smiles and I'm smiling at her, you know, she's looking at me and it's like one of those things where she's like, you know, it's time for you to get up and come and ask me what my name is and introduce yourself. And I kind of got that. So I was like, okay, I will. And I got up and my heart started racing. And because one of my biggest fears was talking to beautiful women. And so I'm walking towards her and I'm smiling and she's smiling and I'm nervous. My hand's shaking, my heart's beating. And then I just pass her right up and I go right into the bathroom. And I'm thinking, God, Peter, what are you doing? I'm looking straight in the mirror. And I'm like, Peter, what are you doing? And I just said, okay, Peter, go out there, man. Go get her phone number. Do something. Just get out there. And I said, fine. And so I opened the door and I went right down the hallway and I turned and I went to her booth and she was gone. Exactly. And so I have the courage at this point, so I'm scrambling and I go to the door to the parking lot and I'm looking out of the parking lot and she's across from the parking lot and she's getting into her car and she drove away.
Mm.
And it was, and I don't say this lightly, it was the worst night of my life. And I was just sitting there and I said, what am I going to do? I felt absolutely helpless. And later on that night, I was mortified. And I was mortified because I realized for the first time, and it was this, it just simply because of the contrast of how I was feeling and how I was feeling before, I was enraged at myself. I was ashamed. I was humiliated. And I was experiencing myself as a total and complete coward. And so I realized that I had, you know, it's like the old saying, how you're doing anything is how you're doing everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like the old cliche, you know, I was looking at my life and I was looking at all the moments that I just sort of let slip through my fingers. I was looking at the life that I was leading right now or at that moment. And I was like, I am absolutely consumed by fear. And I don't mean the kind of fear that you have when you're holding a snake or with a spider. I'm talking about the sneaky kind, the kind that is so subtle that you don't know it's there. It's the kind that talks you out of talking to a girl or a guy that you're interested in. It's the subtle fear that talks you out of starting that business with that idea that you know you want or that idea that you know would be successful if you took action. It's that thing that prevents you from living a hell yes life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's where it all started, man. And so that night I made a vow. I said, this is it. From here on out, I will never, ever let another moment like that ever slip through my fingers. And it was in that moment of decision. And that's the thing. Decision is the thing that causes your destiny. And that day I made a decision, like incision. I cut away anything else that wasn't related to me living my dreams.
Mm.
And that's when Conquer Any Fear happened. That's when my whole movement happened. And it didn't start with me just saying, hey man, I want to help other people. It was literally like, I want to be able to cure my fear so I can live my life.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew this, Norman, I knew the strategies. I knew the plans. I was a self-help addict. You know, if you're gonna go to Barnes and Noble, man, I would be in the self-help section just reading all day with a cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm. Oh but yeah, I'd be right there with you. Yeah,
yep. You totally would be. But I was missing the biggest component in my life, which was how do you overcome that fear? That fear that just stops you before you even start. And so the last 4 years now, I've dedicated my life to really understanding the psychology of fear and how to create that champion mindset so you can take action towards the things in life that we really know we want.
And I had been working on a book about my grandfather, a Holocaust survivor, and I said, I'm going to give myself 1 year to finish that book. It had been like 17 years I'd been working on it. And I said, okay, I'm going to quit my job. And I found this tiny apartment, and it was 90 square feet, and the rent was great. It was $700, which in New York is like free. It's in Upper West Side, a great area. And I thought, I can do this. And I said, I'm going to do it just for 1 year. But you know, that year ended up changing my life.
Tell us how that changed your life. So you're living in a 90 square foot apartment. And by the way, there's a YouTube video about this that has received 15 million views. So I think we officially qualify that as a viral video. So tell us about that.
Yeah. So the apartment was 12 feet by 7.5 feet, roughly the perimeter of my Honda Accord, because I traced it on my parents' driveway. And it was this tiny place. But, you know, I'd been working as an organizer for years, and I knew that, like the city itself, the buildings have to go up. When you organize, your stuff has to go up. So I thought, I can do this. It's just for a year. I put 77 boxes of stuff into storage, and I'm going to do this for 1 year. Well, that first night, I ended up having a panic attack because the tiny loft bed had only 23 inches of space between the mattress and the ceiling. And I freaked out, and I got out of the bed, and I thought, what am I going to do? I can't do this. There's no way I'm going to be able to spend another night here. And I had a friend stay over because I thought I'd roll out of the loft bed. And as I was freaking out, she said to me, you know, why did you choose to live here? And I reminded myself it was to write my grandfather's book. And at that moment, I started remembering the stories my grandfather told me of what he had been through in 8 different camps and being hungry and seeing death every day. And I thought, this tiny place is paradise compared to that. I said, I'm going to be fine. And after that, I never had a panic attack again. And it turns out that living in that small space ended up making my life better. I ended up staying 5 years because the lifestyle I had created for myself suddenly was phenomenal. I had only worked part-time as an organizer, and with lower expenses, I had more free time. And that was my aha moment. That was when I realized, hell yes, I can keep living like this as long as I want. And that became the topic of my next book after my grandfather's book.
I pretended that everything was okay all the time when it wasn't. And as a nurse, it was very easy for me to take myself out of my own pain and deal with other people's pain. Like, I mean, dealing with someone that's got a massive burn injury or someone who's dying of cancer seemed a lot more worse than my own thing. But you can only do that for so long, right? So slowly, slowly over time, after not dealing with anything, and more issues happening, more things coming up, and I still put on this mask in front of everybody that everything's okay, really deep down, it wasn't. I was one giant mess. And my chapter 6 is actually called Bird with a Broken Wing, because that was the worst time of my life. I was done, right? I couldn't even pretend anymore. So my coping skills were I started drinking, and that slowly just kind of started out slowly, and It was a 10-year, I call it a drinking career, because I gave it a good shot. But yeah. I mean, I've been sober 5 years now, which is fantastic. But that Great. Career led me to losing my nursing job, led me to losing my apartment. My daughter wouldn't talk to me anymore. Like, there's a whole bunch of things that were involved just because I couldn't take care of myself. And that actually led, this is where my changing moment came from. That led, it all, like, all led one step to the other, led me to being homeless for a week. And that 1 week may not sound like a lot to a lot of people, but for me, it was enough to realize, like, oh my God, I'm an educated woman. How the heck did I end up here? And so on the seventh day, I'm walking, like, I was kind of, my head was in a real fog, you know, that deep, dark depression where there's no even more room for tears any longer. Well, I'm walking with this guy named Toothless Joe. he was the guy that kind of, he knew the savvy, he's a savvy guy on the street. He knew where to get stuff. And I figured if I'm going to be homeless, I'm going to hang out with someone who knows, you know, the ins and outs. So as I'm walking along with him, depressed beyond depressed, he slaps me on the back really hard. And he says, "This is the life. Live it. Love it." And he was quite happy with it, you know, this big toothless grin. And I look at him, like, he hit me so hard on the back, and it's as if it cleared up the fog in my head. And I got this, I like, the smoke dissipated, right? And I had this single moment of clarity. And I look at him and I said, "What did you say?" And he's just grinning at me. And so I look at him and I'm like, "No." I like, hell no, this is not my life. I actually stomped my foot and I said it even louder. I said, "This is not my life. You might be accepting of this circumstances. No, this ain't happening." So I turned around and I went straight to the hospital, went to get the help I needed. And over the next 2 years, this is all I did was focus on myself and where I needed to be. And honestly, that picture on the cover of the truck was 2 years to the day of my stand from standing beside Toothless Joe. Next thing you know, I'm standing beside this truck. So just think about that. It doesn't take a long time. And next, you don't know where your future is going to take you. I mean, how do you go from Toothless Joe to the biggest truck in the world? Right. Thinking, "Oh, hell yeah, I'll take this. This is awesome."
I thought it was serious, but candidly, I didn't know how serious it was until he started going nose first down into the river. And at that point in time, it was it was so quiet you could hear a pin drop on the plane. That's one of the things I think really was a save. I use the word saving grace on that plane, because no one lost control. No one freaked out. No one was screaming. Everybody, I think, was internalized at that point, thinking, "This is pretty well it. I better get things squared away, either by texting or calling my loved ones and or getting squared away with your creator," which was exactly what I was doing at that moment in time.
Wow. So you really had that moment where you thought, "This is it. This is the end of my life.
This is it."
And yep. How long did that moment last? Did that go on for several minutes where people were still just unsure of how this was going to turn out?
Well, from the time he crossed over the George Washington, the time of impact on the river was somewhere between 60 and 70 seconds. So literally it was a minute of the time from that moment, because what happened is he collided the plane. He had to keep up speed, and this is some technical jargon that I've learned over the last few years, but he had to maintain a speed of 120 miles an hour to keep the plane above the river. But as he picked the nose up to get it over the bridge, he lost that speed. So as he got over the bridge, he had to put the nose down to regain speed. And of course, you put the nose down, you're heading straight into the river.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So then what happened?
Well, when he hit,
we kind of know what happened, but take it.
Well, when he hit, it was a hard hit, and I went back in my seat and back forward really quick. It was like a really jarring hit. He estimates, I've heard on him on the interview, say he hit between 100 and 120 miles an hour. So it was a hard hit. But when I hit, I came back up, and as soon as I sort of got back up from going back and forward, I looked up and looked out the window, and I saw light in the window, but I also saw water immediately at the window level. So I knew that we were alive, but candidly, here's where everything started for me. I think pretty much all the passengers at that point in time was, you know, getting out of a sinking plane. And, you know, that the plane was taking on water immediately because of the way it hit. The bottom of the plane was sort of stripped off. And then someone listened to the flight crew and tried to open up that back door, and water started coming in the back door immediately. So now you got water coming in from underneath the plane and water coming in from the back of the plane. So depending where you were on that plane, I was towards the back. I was at seat 15A. Water was anywhere from ankle knee to waist deep pretty much immediately. So it was coming in rapidly. And at that point, the term I've used in the media many times was controlled chaos, where people were moving fast and there was, you know, a lot of excitement, but no one was losing their heads. And I think that was, once again, part of the outcome that doesn't get talked about a lot. The passenger makeup of that plane really caused people not to lose their heads, but focused on the outcome.
Wow. So yeah, there was something collectively where everyone managed to keep a certain level of calm that might have not have been the case in similar situations. But obviously that boded well for everyone there that day. Okay. And so then tell me a little bit more about, so there you are, you're at the back of the plane, water is starting to fill up the plane. And I think you've talked in some of the interviews I've looked at or in your TED talk about what was going through your head at that time, right?
Yeah, well, my game plan initially was pretty much primarily like everybody else in that plane, get to the aisle, get up, and get out. But when I got to the aisle, something happened to change that perspective for me. And it was my mother, who had passed away in 1997 when I was a child. She used to tell me, and probably my sister and brother likewise, that if you do the right thing, God will take care of you. And one of the great things, Norman, about my mother is she would never tell us directly what to do, but she would give us a choice, and hopefully we'd make the right choice. And the choice that I made was, you know, you help other people first. I grew up in teams and all the time in sports and athletics and Boy Scouts. And so I went towards the back of the plane to see if anybody needed help. And once we got everybody out from the back of the plane, I started making my way out of the plane. And of course, at that time, water was about waist deep to chest deep. Bins had broken open, and luggage is floating in the water. It's dark in the back of the plane. So every time I took a step, I hit something. And candidly, I didn't know what I was hitting at that point. I didn't know if it was just a piece of luggage or somebody was still there. But all the further I could get up was 10F. And that's when I started trying to make my way out of the plane, is when I got to 10F, like everybody else. But when I got to the door, it was an amazing sight. There was no room on that wing or the boat for me. So that's why I was inside the plane waist deep in 36-degree water for about 7 minutes. Holding on that little lifeboat as close as I could to that wing to keep it close. And that's how I became the last passenger out of the plane.
Wow. Wow. So there you are, you're waist deep in 36-degree water. At that point, are you still thinking, I don't know if I'm going to make it out of this, or does it feel like there's, you know, a bridge to safety here?
Well, there's adrenaline running, and I think that's what I tell people. And I've talked to EMTs and military folks and fire and policemen, and they all sort of mimic the same thing, is when you're in that moment, it's adrenaline. So at that moment, I was just focused on, you know, okay, looking at what was going on and assessing when I could get out. But, you know, that moment came for me a few minutes later when I felt a shimmy on the plane. And what I found out later, after talking to the gentleman who owned a tugboat who hit the front of the plane, that's what caused the shimmy. And, you know, of course, when a tugboat hits a plane and it's you're waist deep in the water, and all of a sudden the water starts sloshing back and forth, and you, all of a sudden, my first thought was, this plane's going down, man. It's like Titanic. You know, it's, this thing's going down. And, you know, one thing I remember from that movie is you don't want to be stuck inside it, you know, inside of a plane going down. It's you want to get out. And that was the moment I said, all right, man, it's time to get out of here, time to go. And that's when I jumped in and start swimming to the closest boat that I could find, which happened to be the end of that wing.
Wow. Wow. So, so you jumped into the water. There was no room on the wing. And so, you jumped into the water and swam to the closest boat.
It was about 7 minutes inside the plane. And when all this was going on, and all of a sudden, that's when I felt the shimmy, and that's when I jumped in and swam. And I, you know, to this point, I know how to swim, which I give credit to my parents for making me learn how to swim. It's one of those lessons in life that you know, these things, all these, I got to talk about my book, Moments Matter, all these moments in your life that you don't think mean anything, all of a sudden matter. In that one moment that you know, you learn something when you're 9 years old, all of a sudden, you know, you're 40 years later, pays off.
after all of this, from the, you know, the whole stupid token woman competition thing, to the infighting in our own team, to the disaster of the storm, to trying again, to being the very last team left. You literally, we've only got a day or two before the Sherpas who keep the ladders in the ice fall, pull the ladders and say the season's over. So we're racing against a real time limit. So there's this amazing moment of, yes, we worked so hard for so long and we kept on trying and we kept coming back and it's worked. And then within 12 hours, it had all gone wrong again.
Mm-hmm. I want to back up just before we get to that part. Was it on your route up to the summit, you got a phone call from someone, or was it right before you did that?
Yes, it was on our way back up. So we'd got ourselves back up to Camp 2. We were busy working, moving equipment further up the mountain. There was plenty of people in South Africa who thought this was a terrible idea. I mean, South Africa has no mountain culture, really. So when we claimed beforehand we're going to Everest and Everest is risky, it's like, yeah, of course it is. Yeah, everybody would say that. And then it turned out that, yes, it's actually risky. This is what mm-hmm. risk looks like. It looks like, you know, potentially climbers can get killed. People were horrified back in South Africa. So we've sort of gone back up against all common wisdom. And we get this phone call. And it has to be patched onto our radio system. So it's base camp on the radio saying, oh, it's President Nelson Mandela. It's like, yeah, no, don't. No, of course it isn't, you know. And it was. It was. Wow. We had our own personal Invictus moment. The president of South Africa phoned us up to say, guys, I am proud of you for trying again. I believe you can do this.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
How did that feel? I mean, that sounds completely surreal to be up on top of Mount Everest talking to Nelson Mandela and to hear him say that, you know, like I remember hearing that in your other interview and thinking, oh my gosh, what is he going to say? Is he going to say, hey, you guys shouldn't do this? But no, he ended up saying, hey, I believe in you.
Yes, it was. It was so affirming. And I think that was what was important. You know, we were walking our own path. We were trying to do something that we did think was reasonable. But there was so much negativity about it. And it does mean we were sort of constantly second guessing whether we were being realistic about this thing. And it's not that he had the faintest idea whether or not we could climb Everest. He had no idea. I mean, amazing guy, great political leader, not a mountain climber. But just for him to say that and say it publicly, because that phone call went out on radio in South Africa.
Wow.
So he's saying it publicly. And it's just that support. I mean, I think one of the toughest things about trying to live your hell-yes life, whatever it is the number of people who will tell you, oh, no, you know, but what, but this, but that, it might go wrong. What if, you know, oh, yes, other people can do that. But you, seriously, you know, there's so many ways in which well-meaning people in our lives undercut us. And, you know, that's not even counting the trolls in our lives. To have someone who matters to you stand up and say, yeah, you're doing good. I believe you can pull this off. That makes such a difference. We were so motivated after that.
So in 1994, my band, The Presidents of the United States of America, was a hot commodity, and about seven different major labels wanted to sign us all at once. And so we had to make a lot of decisions really fast, and we whittled it down to two choices. One was Columbia, which is part of Sony Records, and the other was Madonna's label, Maverick, which was a small label, but it was Madonna, and she was very interested. So in order to figure this out, we had a business meeting with Madonna, which was pretty exciting. She had come to see our band the night before at the Dragonfly in Los Angeles, and she had on the typical baseball hat, sunglasses, sort of like the disguise that celebrities wear when they don't want to be recognized, but they absolutely look like celebrities trying not to be recognized. So anyway, she was pretty obvious. The next day we had a meeting, and we were there at the appointed time because as a band, we are incredibly punctual. So we were there and she wasn't, and we were getting restless and waiting and waiting and waiting. And we decided to toss around this little Nerf football that we had with us. That was our way of kind of getting a little exercise on the road. We'd stop at a truck stop or whatever and pull out the little football and fly around for a while to get our blood flowing from sitting in the bus or the van. So we were in the parking lot of her LA offices tossing this little football around, and somebody's head poked out of the door and said, "Hey, she's here. Come on in." And so everybody went in, but I was sort of feeling a little relaxed and not like rushing. So I was kind of tossing the football up in the air to myself and catching it. And the door had been propped open to the interior of the building. And I kind of thought to myself, I wonder if I could throw the football in an arc and have it land inside the hallway and me run into the hallway and catch it. Like, could I throw it to myself? And I did. I threw a high arc and ran and got in the hallway and landed with a big thunk, a big thud in the hallway on the carpeting and caught the football. And then I felt something by my foot. And I was wearing very thick leather boots, kind of 1920s brakeman railroad worker style work boots. And I felt something through the side of my boot. And I looked down, and to my horror was Madonna's dog. And at the time she had no children. She had nothing else going on but this dog. If she was on the cover of a magazine or if she did a photo shoot, she had the dog. The dog was a little tiny, extremely bone frail chihuahua with a tennis ball sized head. And it was looking up at me and shaking violently. And its little eyeballs were tearing up. And my entire system went blank, you know, like white with terror. And the dog was unharmed. I mean, it was so close to my boot that if I'd landed, you know, half an inch to the left, I would have crushed its little body completely. And nobody's in the hallway. Everybody's gone ahead. So it's just me and Madonna's dog alone in the hallway. And it's kind of like, I won't tell if you don't tell. And the dog just took off down the hallway and went around the corner. And I followed after a couple of heartbeats. So I'm very nervous, you know, from that. And I get in this office and she's still not there. And I'm looking at stuff on the shelves, you know, like albums and books, and kind of perusing with my back to the door. And she must have snuck in and sort of put her finger to her lips and told everybody to be quiet because nobody made a sound. But the next thing I knew, there was a tap tap on my shoulder, and I turned around and Madonna was right in my face, like 4 inches from my nose. And everybody laughs, ha ha, and she's like, "I got you." So that's a good start. Then we have a very productive meeting. She really understood our attitude, how we wanted to make joyful music, how we cared deeply about making this, you know, music that sounded really easy. And she understood what we were trying to do. And it was a very positive meeting. And at the end, she kind of took me aside and she said, "Listen, whether you sign with me or not, I want to give you a piece of advice." And the advice was, "You are funny and your songs are fun, so you will never receive, critical acclaim or validation for the craft and the hard work that you have to put into doing what you do." And she turned out to be very correct, and she saved me a lot of trouble, a lot of worry over, because, you know, on the other end of things, we ended up signing with Columbia, and they were telling us, "Oh, you guys are important songwriters and you're a big deal and you're really like saving music at this point in life, you know, at this point in time. You're bringing humor back and everybody needs it. And, you know, you're the greatest thing since sliced bread." And so Madonna's comment tempered my acceptance of that kind of praise, and also made it so that I just focused on what made me happy, which was making this joyful music and spending energy doing it well, rather than trying to do it quick and easy and, just sort of fishing for compliments. So there you go. I went from almost killing her dog to receiving extremely valuable advice from her in about an hour.
Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Hell Yes Life podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite RSS feed. If you like the show, please leave a rating and review. And if you want to stay connected, visit hellyeslife.com and sign up for the e-newsletter and private Facebook group. Again, I'm Norman Bell. Thanks for joining me. Now let's get out there and live a Hell Yes Life.